The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight I'm going to continue talking about a topic we've been exploring both in my talk and discussions for the last few weeks. We've been exploring the topic of dukkha, the Pali term dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering. I didn't want to say we talked about suffering because that might just seem so heavy to start, but just to give you a little bit of a sense of this term, dukkha, you know, it's usually translated as suffering almost just for expediency's sake, but it's really got a very broad meaning. It's not simply the kind of suffering that we normally think of as suffering. It includes that, the kind of suffering that we think of when we have something really fearful happen to us, or something really frustrating happen to us, or we get ill, or a loved one is ill and dies. It includes that kind of obvious kinds of suffering. And a couple of weeks ago, we spent really exploring those obvious kinds of suffering. This kind of suffering is what is often called the dukkha of pain. It's often related to unpleasant experience, things that are unpleasant in our experience and how we react to them. So this term dukkha is much broader than that. It includes the subtlest kinds of uneasiness, of existential anxiety. It includes a wide range of states of mind that we might not normally think of as suffering, or might not be obvious to us as suffering from the start. So sometimes people translate this term dukkha as dissatisfaction, or uneasiness, or stress. Those are some other ways that we can think of this term. So you may not particularly feel at this moment like there is a suffering in your experience, but you may have a sense of some stress. And this term dukkha incorporates that term. And so the exploration around dukkha, the exploration around, and I'll use probably dukkha and suffering interchangeably during this talk. That's the translation I'm most familiar with, and we'll probably use it. But in my saying that, understand that it has this broader connotation. So this dukkha that we experience is not so much about what's happening in the world, or even what's happening physically in our bodies. It is mostly about a kind of reactivity that happens in our minds. So what is meant by this term of dukkha is not the unpleasantness of experience or the reactivity that happens when something pleasant disappears or changes, but rather it's the mind's the mental reaction, response to this, to our situation. So, for example, in this first kind of suffering, the dukkha of pain, if we cut ourselves with a knife, there's the physical pleasant, unpleasant sensation. That's there. And that's not going to change. But what happens to us is that we respond to that physical unpleasantness with mental anger or fear or irritation or frustration or annoyance. And that is what is the dukkha. It's this mental reactivity. So a couple of weeks ago, we really explored this obvious kind of dukkha, the dukkha of pain. And then last week, we explored a little bit of a more subtle kind of dukkha, what is called often the dukkha of change, which is the kind of the dukkha that is kind of inherent in the it's kind of inherent in our pleasant experience when we cling to that pleasant experience, when we expect that pleasant experience to stay, when we feel like we can control or manipulate our environment so that our pleasant experiences continue. We can do that for a time, but after some period of time, the law of impermanence kicks in, and that pleasant experience naturally falls apart, even with all of our efforting to keep it going. And so the clinging to that pleasant experience, when we hold on to that pleasant experience, there's kind of an inherent suffering in that holding on to something that's pleasant. Even while it is happening, even while that pleasant experience is happening, if we are holding on to it, hoping it will continue, trying to manipulate and maneuver for it to continue, we will suffer when it ends. Because of that very holding, that very expectation that it shouldn't end, the idea, the belief that this is the way it should be, pleasant experience is the way my life should be, the belief perhaps that if my life is not filled with pleasant experience, then somehow I'm a failure or somebody else is doing something to me so that I can't have this pleasant experience. So it's that mental response, the mental reactivity that is the dukkha, and it is that clinging, which is also a mental activity, the clinging to pleasant, when we hold on to it, wanting it to continue, trying to keep it there. It's that clinging itself, that holding on to, that is what is so painful when the pleasant experience ends. If you can imagine, just reflect now on how it might feel if there was absolutely no issue for you, no problem whatsoever, if a pleasant experience ended. Or if it was absolutely no problem whatsoever if there was an unpleasant experience in your life. Life would be quite a bit different if we did not have that kind of reactivity, either to push away the unpleasant or to try to hold on to the pleasant. If that reactivity wasn't there, life would be a lot smoother, a lot easier. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to change things. I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to get ourselves out of a situation that's unhealthy or dangerous. That's often a way that this teaching is misunderstood, that we are supposed to just sit around and just kind of passively let things happen to us and be completely balanced and at ease with whatever happens to us. The balanced and at ease part, yes, that we are cultivating. But the movement to change things, this teaching isn't about just sitting back and letting people and situations roll over you. It is about learning when the response to the difficult situations is one of anger and aversion, or one of trying to hold on, to try to keep something in place. When there's either one of those movements, that's happening in our own minds. And so the way or the action that we can take the way to maneuver through our life, maneuver through our difficulties, is to see if we can find a way to respond out of compassion, out of kindness, out of balance of mind, rather than reacting out of aversion and desire. So it sounds like it's impossible to want to change something or to have the movement towards changing without having either an aversion or a desire. But it is possible. It can be a movement of compassion of heart instead of aversion. And so the teaching is more about looking at where there is that aversion and that desire to hold on, and seeing if we can release some of that clinging in order that our heart might be open to meet whatever is happening. And when our heart is open, it can respond from this place of compassion, of kindness. So that's just a brief summary of what we've kind of talked about the last couple of weeks. And today I'd like to talk about a kind of a really subtle form of this dukkha, a subtle form of this suffering, which really encompasses the most subtle forms of unease. It's called in the Pali for it, for those of you who are interested in this kind of thing, is sankhara dukkha. And sankhara basically means something like coming into being or being formed. So this is the suffering of things coming into being, the suffering of the formation of things. This is this kind of suffering is it's pretty subtle. It's not so obvious to us, but I think I can kind of give you a flavor of it through, you know, talking about various ways that it might manifest. So this kind of suffering is said to be related to how we react to neutral experience. So you might have noticed a pattern that a couple weeks ago we talked about the dukkha of pain, the suffering of pain. And that's really about how we react to unpleasant experience. And then last week we talked about the dukkha of change. And that's about how we react to pleasant experience. So this one tonight, this dukkha of formations, is about how we react to neutral experience. So we don't particularly notice neutral experience that much. And when we do, it's often with a sense of boredom, of why do I need to do this thing, or this thing, we just have to do this thing in order to kind of keep things going. So, you know, what are our lives? Our lives consist of a lot of this kind of stuff. You know, we get up in the morning, we have to brush our teeth, we put on our clothes, we make our bed, we make our breakfast, we wash the dishes, we get the kids to school, we get ourselves ready to go to work, we drive to work, we spend our day at work to earn the money so that we can come home and have dinner and buy the food and make dinner, and we do this every day. And as one of my teacher says, we do this over and over and over again until we die. That's what our life consists of. It's a lot of this neutral experience, this just doing because we have to do it in order to live. It's just kind of the dukkha of living. Now, it's not particularly felt necessarily as dukkha, not necessarily felt as suffering. It's just what we have to do over and over again. But most of us have had the sense of this kind of existential angst of, well, is this all there is? You know, this getting up, going to work, coming home, buying the food, making the food, going to bed, sleeping, getting up, going to work, blah, just over and over again. Is this all there is? So this suffering of formations is kind of about the sense that we have that there must be something more. So I think, you know, sometimes I have a sense, you know, I haven't seen this anywhere in any of the texts or the teachings, but I have a sense that the urge or the need for us to have meaning in our lives arises out of this sankhara dukkha. It arises out of this sense of the kind of everyday just routineness that we have this sense of needing to find a meaning. There's a funny kind of cartoon that I heard about. I haven't actually seen the cartoon, but it was so clearly described that I can visualize it. It's one of those cartoons that shows, you know, the kind of evolution of creatures. You know, you've got the fish in the water, and then there's a little bit up on the further on the beach. There's a little being that's crawling out of the water with legs, and you know, so it's kind of got the range of evolution. And over each creature is a little thought bubble, and over the fish in the water, there's a little thought bubble that says, "Eat, survive, reproduce," and over the next little creature that's coming out of the water, the one that's just got a few legs, is the little thought bubble that says, "Eat, survive, reproduce." And then there's the next little creature that's on the land, you know, mammal on the land, and the little thought bubble over it says, "Eat, survive, reproduce." And there's a string of these, and then it comes to man, finally. And the little thought bubble over his head says, "I wonder what it all means." You know, that essentially this self-reflective capacity that we have has turned back on itself, so that just the day-to-day sense of eat, survive, reproduce doesn't feel like enough. It's not what, it feels like there's something more, it needs to be something more. And I personally feel like there is, in a sense, something more, but it's not to be found through fighting with the nature of things as they are, but more the willingness to meet just how things are. And it relates back to that willingness to just meet whatever is here, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, with an open heart, without resistance, without reactivity. Because with that open heart, when that open heart is just able to move through the world, it responds in a very beautiful way. It responds in a compassionate way, in a kind way. And to me, that's the most beautiful meaning, in a way. The most beautiful meaning is not to have something external to latch onto that's the meaning, but just the mere meeting of experience moment by moment with an open heart. And that produces such a beautiful response in the world. That, to me, feels very meaningful. But it's not an idea of meaning. It's a different kind of meaning, in a way. But I think we, you know, this creation of meaning, you know, what does my life mean? You know, trying to find something to orient our lives around. I think some of that comes out of this meeting of the routineness of everydayness of this sankhara dukkha. So I want to go back and talk a little bit about the neutrality aspect. Um, when things are neutral in our experience, as I said a few minutes ago, often we react by either boredom or, you know, just feeling like something else should be happening, you know, just kind of like, okay, this is the grind. There's something more that's supposed to be happening. This is not the way it's supposed to be. So there's that neutrality that's going on, and we don't actually like neutrality very much. It's, you know, if we're really honest with ourselves, we would prefer the reactivity of anger to neutrality. We prefer the highs and the lows to neutrality. Neutrality feels kind of threatening to us. I think because it, you know, with the highs and the lows, when we're in those moments of highs and lows, we have a real defining sense of who we are. And we're in the neutrality, it's like, whoa, you know, what? Who am I? You know, is this isn't really important. So there's a sense of, you know, striving out or reaching out for, when we're in this place of neutrality, of wanting to reach out for something that confirms me, confirms who I am. And this is one of the central confusions of our minds, that we think that this identity, this, you know, that identity is a fundamental important piece of who we are. And actually, identity is something that's just created by our minds. It's not something fundamental. It's a kind of, who we are is really this flow of changing experience, of changing mental states and physical states. There's nothing solid or stable here that we can just pin down and say, yep, that's me. That's my identity. That's who I am. There are some very strong habits and patterns that we have that keep reappearing. We have patterns of anger, or patterns of excitement, or patterns of frustration. You know, ways in which it feels over and over again, like, yep, I'm familiar with that one. That's me. So there's ways in which these patterns and habits feel so familiar that they it's kind of like the body and mind kind of lock into that and go, yep, that's me. And it kind of feels comfortable because it's so familiar in a way. So when we meet these neutral places, we actually find that we start, that the mind, because it's not so comfortable in this neutral place, the mind will start trying to figure out ways to create this sense of identity. So essentially, when we're in these neutral places, our habits and patterns kind of kick in and say, okay, got to find who I am, and what's the most close thing in the neighborhood that's going to prove to me who I am and what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So for instance, I'll give you an example of this from my own practice. I have had in my life a very strong habit of feeling like I'm a failure, like I'm no good, like I'm unworthy, like I can't do things right, that kind of thing, you know, kind of a sense of unworthiness. And I have, in the course of my life on retreats and my meditation practice, I have really spent a lot of time observing that pattern, watching it as it has come into being, what causes it to come into being, what makes it fall apart. So I spent a lot of time watching that pattern. And on one retreat where I was watching my experience, there was one retreat where I found myself in this space of neutral a lot, but there wasn't much happening. It was like there wasn't a lot of really blissful states happening, and there wasn't a lot of dukkha states happening either. It was just kind of this neutral territory. And I was hanging out in that neutral territory and began seeing that the mind had a hard time hanging out there. It did a couple things. One of the first things it did was kind of expecting something good might happen in this neutral space. That as you learn more and more about these teachings and this practice, you learn that the space of neutrality, the space of balance of mind, the space of balance of mind can sometimes feel very neutral. There's not much going on. And from that space, sometimes there can be a deeper breakthrough to understanding and wisdom. And so hanging out in this space of neutral, there's kind of this little bit of, I wonder if there's going to be a deeper breakthrough into wisdom. And so I'd be hanging out there and nothing would happen. And almost immediately after that, the mind would go, oh, you're a failure. Out of nothing, out of neutral experience, the mind projected that something might happen. When it didn't happen, it came back and said, well, you're a failure. Fortunately, I was mindful enough to catch this process, but I could see how, from neutral experience, the habits of mind, the particularly familiar and strong patterns of mind will tend to just begin. So this is a great place for mindful exploration. When you find yourself in a space where it feels like there's not much happening, take an interest in how your mind reacts to that, because it's probably going to react in some of the ways that your mind tends to do habitually. It'll either start creating fantasies to make things seem great, or it'll start creating disaster scenarios and start planning about how to maneuver those disaster scenarios. We all have our own habits and patterns and ways of dealing with things. And from this neutral space, it's like those habits are just waiting for some opportunity to begin. So, having talked about dukkha, the suffering, for some time now, the last few weeks, I want to put it in context of what the Buddha had to say about dukkha. What I've been saying is some of what the Buddha said about dukkha, but within the context of the First Noble Truth, the Four Noble Truths being kind of the key insights that the Buddha woke up to when he had his awakening experience, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the possibility for suffering to end, and the truth that there is a way to behave in this world and train our minds such that we can affect that ending of suffering. So this First Noble Truth, sometimes it sounds like the proof that these Buddhist teachings are really nihilistic or, negative, this truth of suffering. But actually, I think of it as, it's the opposite in a way, because the Buddha pointed to this truth of suffering rather than not, ignoring it or putting it aside or trying to come into blissful states of meditation and just put those states of suffering out of the mind. He talked about actually meeting our experience, meeting experience here and now, and noticing how we react to it. And that if we can come to balance of mind around what's happening, everything that's happening in our experience, then we will no longer suffer. So this First Noble Truth, the truth of suffering, is about the possibility, it is inherent in it, is about the possibility that it's possible to be free of this dukkha. Because this dukkha that is being described here, this dukkha that's being described, is about how our mind is responding to experience. And it's possible to change the way our minds respond to experience. It's not possible to change the world and what happens in the world. Sometimes it's possible to change some of it, but we can't change all of it. But we can learn how to respond with an open heart, meet our experience with compassion, with kindness, with balance of mind, and even with joy when there are beautiful things that are being experienced. So in this First Noble Truth, the Buddha talked about kind of three levels of understanding this First Noble Truth. And the first level is simply understanding what this dukkha is. This is dukkha, or there is dukkha. This is suffering. So to begin to understand what suffering is, and this suffering is this reactivity that is arising out of these movements of greed, aversion, and delusion in our mind. So just recognizing, beginning to recognize suffering as suffering. That sounds like not like something that we'd want to see or recognize, but it's actually an insight. When we meet experience and recognize it, oh, this is suffering. That's actually an insight, because we can then turn to that suffering and start to meet it, to understand it. And this is the second aspect of the understanding that the Buddha talks about around the First Noble Truth. He said suffering should be understood. That's what he said that we should do with suffering. And again, this points to the idea or the notion of changing our relationship to suffering. That when we meet suffering, and the movement towards it is understanding, as opposed to trying to get rid of it, it's a different relationship. It's a different relationship to suffering when we meet it and wish to understand it. So the second noble truth, the second aspect of the First Noble Truth, suffering should be understood, is a kind of understanding or recognizing that reorientation towards suffering. That it is worth paying attention to suffering. Again, this is an insight that suffering isn't meant to be just pushed away. It's actually worth paying attention to. And why is it worth paying attention to? Because it happens in our mind, and it arises out of these movements of wanting to get rid of and wanting to hold on to. And if we can understand those movements of wanting to get rid of and wanting to hold on to, understanding those movements, they begin to reveal themselves for what they are, which is simply kind of the activity of a mind that is out of balance. So understanding suffering, this when the Buddha says to understand suffering, this isn't an analytical exploration. It's not an understanding of thinking about how we get into suffering and thinking about it, thinking about who did what to whom and how they did it and why they did it. That kind of exploration is not what is meant by understanding suffering. What is meant is turning towards the actual experience. What does it feel like to be a human being that is experiencing this suffering? It's a very compassionate move to do that, to turn towards our suffering. This turning towards with mindfulness being willing to embrace our suffering as opposed to trying to push it away and fix it and change it and get rid of it. It's a completely different orientation. It's kind of like the difference between seeing a child that is, in a state of distress and trying to distract them with all kinds of things so that they don't notice their distress, versus the movement to just say, oh, I see that you're sad, and picking them up and holding them on your lap and just letting them feel what they feel. Not trying to fix it or change it, but to just embrace it. It's a very compassionate act to meet suffering in this way. And we can do this for ourselves. We can also do it for others. It's very powerful if you are willing and able to meet somebody in their suffering and not be afraid of it, not feel like you're going to get overwhelmed by it, but just able to be with them in that suffering. I had an opportunity, a wonderful, beautiful opportunity to sit with somebody who was going through some very strong grief, a memory of something that had happened in his childhood. And I didn't know what to say, but I could just sit there, and I was just trying to be as present as I could for his experience. And I didn't know what was going on for him, but a couple days later he came back to me and said, what were you doing? And I said, I was just trying to be there with you. And he said, it was amazing. So we can meet our own suffering in this way, through the willingness to just turn towards it. It's a beautiful, compassionate expression to not resist it, but to open to it. So turning towards it with mindfulness, exploring our suffering, how does it feel in the body? How does the mind respond? Not rejecting any of it, but being aware of all of it. It's a challenging task. And at times the suffering is so strong, it is so powerful that it feels overwhelming, and it's hard at times to turn towards it. And at those times we need to learn skillful strategies for compassionately redirecting our attention, not out of aversion, but out of compassion for ourselves and for the suffering, realizing that if we try to meet that suffering, we're just going to get swept away. So learning how and when to skillfully redirect our attention, perhaps just to something neutral, bringing our attention to our sensations of our feet on the ground or the sensations of our hands, just staying present, not trying to fight the feeling, but also not directly attending to it, can be very powerful way of allowing the experience without having to directly go into it. It's kind of like allowing it to be there, and you're just kind of on the edges, just kind of holding the space for that thing to do its thing, but not needing to directly go inside. So as we learn how to meet our suffering, learn how to embrace our suffering, we naturally come to this third understanding that the Buddha talked about with respect to the First Noble Truth, and that is suffering has been understood. Because as we embrace our suffering, as we meet it, we find it shifts radically. And sometimes in that turning to meet our suffering, it's no longer felt as suffering. At first it may just be what is, and then it may shift entirely. Let go, release the anger that we felt when we turned to meet it without resistance, without judgment, just meeting that feeling. It melts. And underneath we find something else entirely. In that suffering has been understood, what we begin to see is kind of the conditional nature of our suffering, how causes and conditions come together to create our experience, both external and internal, and that our internal response to the external situation is the key, and that that turning to embrace, to meet our suffering, creates a real shift in that internal environment. And the suffering begins to fall apart. And when suffering has been fully understood, it does fall apart. And this is really the what I look at as the beautiful, inspiring, joyful teaching of this practice, that when we do embrace our suffering, it melts. So I want to leave some time for discussion. If there's any comments or questions or thoughts of anything that you have about this topic or anything that's come up in your minds. Yeah, and we'll use the mics so that it can be heard in the recording.
Thank you. I've come to these talks for a few months now, and when I hear you speak, I'm looking for answers. And it seems like you have found the answers, but through many years of meditation. And I'm saying, how quick can I get to where I want to go or a solution? So it's, in listening to you and Gil, it sounds like it's years and years of meditation and searching. And my problems are now, and I don't have that much time. Okay, so... what can I look forward to, or how can I speed the process up?
Well, you know, it's not so much about speeding it up, but what I found, you know, it's like there's been huge transformations in my experience in the years that I've been doing this practice. But within the first year, even within the first few months, that willingness to meet suffering had huge, huge impact on my experience. So it's like I didn't have to wait years before I felt the impact. But it was the willingness to turn to suffering that was the key. If there's any kind of sense of wanting to do anything other than meet suffering as it is, you know, how can I do something that will get me out of this? That will kind of block the way. So really, it is truly about being willing to meet your difficulty here and now. Just, can you come into that experience, embrace that experience? There will be, if you can truly do that, there will be benefits here and now. My first, you know, within the first 2 or 3 months of my practice, I had some openings around very deep states of suffering that really gave me the confidence to keep going. You know, I've described this one experience so many times, I'm hesitant to describe it again, but I'll just briefly describe it to give you a sense. You know, the reason I came into this practice at all was because I was in so much of a state of anger over a particular situation that it was pretty much making me non-functional. I couldn't function in my daily life. And so I started turning to meet that suffering, meet that anger. Whenever I experienced that anger, I made a resolve. On the cushion, off the cushion, it didn't matter. I was just, it was sending me out of control, and so it was just like, I made a really strong resolve. I am going to meet this experience, and I'm going to be mindful of it. I'm just going to turn to it. And I did that over and over again. Whenever it arose, just turn to it. So it takes a strong commitment to doing that, to turning and meeting that experience. And what I discovered over the course of the first few weeks of doing this was that even just that commitment to meet that experience began to change how I experienced it. Initially, when I remembered even to pay attention, you know, when I remembered my commitment to pay attention to that anger, I was in such a rage, it was extremely painful and very difficult to be with. But over the course of several weeks, slowly I began realizing that my remembering to pay attention began happening sooner and sooner. And so the anger didn't have as much of a time to cycle and get into a rage, you know. So it kind of slowed down the process or broke into the process of that anger getting strong. And so there was much more room to maneuver. So even within the first few weeks of this, you know, strong impetus, you know, I'm going to do this, it began to bear fruit. Go ahead.
I hear what you're saying. Now, as this anger came up during the day, how did you approach it? Did you sit down and meditate 10 minutes in the morning, you know,
actually,
10 minutes at noon time?
You know, what I did was just when I felt that anger, in that moment, it's like, what's happening? And I didn't try to do it. I didn't try to figure it out. You know, it's just kind of like, okay, I said I was going to be mindful of this, so, wow, this is unpleasant. That's about all I could do. It's like, yep, I see I'm angry. I'm unpleasant. I didn't have many tools at this stage in my practice. You know, I was pretty new. It was in my first few months of practice. And so it was just pretty much just meeting the anger and recognizing I was angry, kind of using this recognition or even a kind of a labeling. You know, angry. Yes, there's anger here. And after a few minutes of that, you know, it's kind of like, well, what do I do now? Well, I guess I go back to work. You know, so I just kind of met it with a really light touch over and over and over again, every time it came up. Not trying to hang on to it or fix it or change it in that moment, but just meeting what I could meet about it for a few moments. And what I kind of retrospectively understood was even just that meeting it for a few moments gave me enough space around it to even be able to go back to work. So that, you know, it's just a process over the course of several months where, you know, just meet the experience, recognize it, not resist it, not try to fix it, change it, acknowledge it, and then at some point, you know, 30, 40 seconds, okay, guess I can go back to work, you know. Just keep meeting it, keep meeting it, keep meeting it. Every time you meet it, you learn something new. And it's not something you have to think about, what am I learning now? It's just meeting the experience, just the rawness of that experience. Just, it may just be, oh, this is awful, you know, just this feeling. Just, oh, okay, well, awfulness, that's what's happening, awfulness. It's really extremely simple. It's just not very easy to do. It just takes that rededication, committing yourself to just keep trying. And it sounds like you've got that motivation. So channel that motivation. Pick something in particular you are interested in understanding and explore that throughout your day every time it comes up. One of the things the Buddha said about this teaching is that it's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it's good in the end. And that's definitely been my experience, you know, that even in the very early stages, there was so much that I learned openings to ways that my mind worked. It was like, wow, I had no idea it was even possible to see that. No idea it was even possible to recognize a fleeting thought leading to anger. And in recognizing that fleeting thought, realizing, oh, there's a fleeting thought. It can stop there. So it's really just that resolve, that commitment, and that learning about how to turn towards experience without aversion. That those two pieces. Yeah. Do you mind speaking in the mic?
This is my first time here. When you were talking about suffering, death, well, today I had a friend of mine's that in Chicago were passed away. Mm-hmm. And I was at work, and I just felt, I recognized it because she's close to me, and I recognized that as she was talking, I recognized that that was the same feeling when someone is close to, like my dad passed away, and I had that same feeling of it was just a lot of hurt, pain.
Yes.
Right in here. Mm-hmm. And I noticed I was not, became withdrawn. I didn't want to talk, but I had to, answer the phone and stuff like that. So when I came here, I just feel like a sense of peace. Mm-hmm. When the first lady that was here, I was here first, and it became so relaxed. And I'm still relaxed.
That's lovely.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that with you. I was able to recognize exactly what had happened. The reason I was, because when my father passed away, I went to the funeral, but I don't remember anything. Mm-hmm. Because I passed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to therapy and everything. But I can never really remember what happened. But I just, that pain is still there.
Yeah.
So whenever someone is, if you understand what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
Well, whenever somebody close to me pass away, it's just, it brings back all
so
that.
Strong, the strong,
so strong
pain, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like with the meditation, the earlier meditation and with this meditation, your heart relaxed a little bit.
Yeah.
And more is able to accept the hurt than to fight the hurt.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful movement to be able to open like that. Well, thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. And it's 9:00, so we should stop. So thank you all for your participation and your attention. Good evening.